From the International Science School Lectures, this is Dr. Barry Brook on Extinction, Past and Present. It is part one of his necessary but depressing outline of one of the greatest extinction events of all time. The cause is not an asteroid or volcanic eruptions. It is human civilization. The science school ran from July 1st to 14th, 2007, at Sydney, Australia.
You're listening to Eco Science. Lectures from the 34th Professor Harry Messel International Science School, held at the University of Sydney in July 2007. For more information, go to www.scienceschool.usyd.edu.au.
Thank you for that rapturous applause, and now I'll spend the next hour depressing you about things that have died and are no longer here. Extinction is, in some senses, a depressing topic, but in other senses, it's a really exciting one. So today what I'm going to do is give you all of this background on things that used to exist and no longer exist, well, in the main. And tomorrow I'll really depress you by talking about what's going to go this century and how we might go about stopping that happening. That's a pretty important topic. But really, before you understand the future of biodiversity this century and beyond, you need to understand where it's come from, what's happened in the past, and what are the processes driving extinction. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. So the main area I cover in my research is called ecology, and that's the study of the interrelationship between different species, plants and animals, and their environment. And ecology is a process very much involved in other biological disciplines such as evolutionary biology, phylogeny, which is the study of how organisms and their family trees evolved through millions of years, biogeography, which is the study of how organisms have been distributed across the world, how they disperse, how new species arise, and so on. If you can imagine it in this schematic diagram, the Earth is full of what we call biogeographic realms, which are areas where species have arisen, they've been isolated from other areas, and new ecosystems and new biomes have formed. But it's a dynamic sort of process. It's not just a static thing where you have these species arise and they're just there ad infinitum. In fact, species continually go extinct for one reason or another, which I'll talk about today. And new species evolve, and so on. And sometimes they disperse between geographic realms. Sometimes they're very connected. This can have to do with the drifting of continents around the Earth, or it might have to do with a new seaway being opened or closed. So you can have invasions and immigration and emigration. But the key point out of this is that extinction is actually a natural part of this turnover. So we call it biological turnover, which means the changing around of the composition of species. So don't think of extinction as always a bad thing. It's actually a very biologically fundamental thing. If you think about natural sciences in a broad sense, there are a number of main domains. One of them is evolutionary biology, which studies how species arise, the processes that lead to new species being formed. Then there's the science of extinction biology, which really looks at the opposite. It looks at why species die out. And overlapping those very closely is ecology, which is the study of how species, when they're here, so after they've evolved, before they go extinct, the sort of things that they get on with. And the sort of green square is the broader environment in which everything inhabits and interacts. So it's a very sort of broad schematic of where extinction sits in the grand scheme of things. So let's think about that word extinction a bit more carefully. What does it actually mean? Well, on a very fundamental level, it's a pretty simple concept. A species which was once here is no longer here. It's gone. But the actual processes that lead to extinction, actually even how you define when something's extinct, is a pretty complicated thing. Because it really comes down to the matter of how do you prove that something's not there rather than something is there. I mean, you can go out and survey in the field and find an organism of a particular species. You can say it's still extant, extant being the word that's the opposite to extinct. That's simple enough in principle, but how do you actually go about saying, well, it's no longer there? Well, that's what we say is a probabilistic thing, because you can never be sure. You can say, it's probably not there, or I'm pretty certain it's not there, or I'm highly certain it's gone. And we can use various mathematical methods to try and determine that, and I'll give you one example a bit later. A simple way of doing it, and the World Conservation Union, who is a UN-funded body which looks after the management of threatened species and coordinates threatened species lists and so on, they've come up with a fairly basic rule, which is called the 50-year rule. And that says if no one has seen a species after fairly intensive surveys over a 50-year period, we'll call it extinct. So it's taking a pragmatic approach and saying, well, we can't ever be sure, but we can be pretty sure if it's not been there for 50 years. And when you think about extinctions, you have to be careful about how you define it. Because you can have a global extinction, which is probably what all of you think about when you think something's extinct. It means it's found nowhere else on Earth anymore. It's completely gone, irrevocably lost. But in fact, there are processes leading up to that global extinction which are not irrevocable. And that includes local extinction, so it might be just in a particular patch of habitat, or it might be in a country like Australia, it might be in a region like Southeast Asia where a species is no longer found, but it is still found elsewhere. But of course, the process of many local extinctions is what eventually leads to a global extinction, because when the last local population is gone, something's globally extinct. So these are the sort of definitions you need to have in mind when you're thinking about extinction. It's always going to be a probabilistic thing, and it's a scale thing. Do you have a question?
Yeah, with the 50-year rule, it's pretty massive. Like, who has to, like, see? Because I know in different studies, people claim to have seen, like, I don't know, they've seen a Tasmanian tiger or something. Like, who has to identify that there are actually none of these species is still there?
Again, there's no hard and fast rules. I mean, ideally, you'd want something like a photograph or a skin. These days with DNA technology, we can actually be pretty sure by just a piece of tissue or some hair or something that we can identify an organism. So it's getting easier to do that. But originally, it's a pretty hard thing even to prove. Normally, it was done by going out and shooting a thing and bringing back the skin and saying, here it is, especially for the larger things. That tends to be not the way we do it anymore. So let's have a look at a few examples. And these three pictures demonstrate the difficulty with defining extinction. The bird cruising through the sky there is called the Bermuda cowhowl. And that was found by Spanish sailors in around the 15th century, and it used to nest on rocky outcrops. And then no one saw it again. For over 300 years, it was gone. And so everyone presumed it was extinct, certainly well past the 50-year rule. But then, in the 20th century, it was suddenly rediscovered, an isolated part of Bermuda. So that was one which violated the 30-year rule. Then there are other examples of species which may be around, may not be around. Two of the ones I've shown there are a subspecies of red colobus monkey and a Chinese river dolphin called the Baji River dolphin. Now, the river dolphin has been declining quite precipitously over the last 30 years, and it's probably gone extinct because it was certainly well on the way down. No one's seen one for a few years, but it might be around. There may be a few specimens, we can't be sure. The monkey hadn't been seen for perhaps 20 or 30 years, and then someone reported a specimen, but it couldn't be verified. This is an example where couldn't quite be sure. It was a biologist who saw it, but was it really one of those monkeys? Well, in that case, you really need to be a bit more mathematical about how you do it. So rather than just saying 50 years, that's it, we can say, well, let's consider what information we had about that species beforehand. So some species, like the coelacanth, is a classic example where we really got it totally wrong, in that we knew it from fossils going back to the Cretaceous period, so we're talking about 80 million years ago. And it was quite abundant in fossils back then, but no one had seen a living one. And this was called a lobed fin fish. If you have a look at its front fins, they're shaped almost like little legs, and that's what people think the first land animals evolved from. They had these strong fore fins, which are able to drag themselves up onto the land. So this was quite an important sort of relict organism, but it was imagined extinct for 80 million years. Well, in the 20th century, they suddenly dragged one up off the Comoros Islands in the Indian Ocean from a depth of about 4 kilometres. So this thing, which was one of the ancestors of all land animals, had found a new ecological niche for itself in the bottom of the ocean. And we don't know hardly anything that exists in the bottom of the ocean. It's a big mystery. So perhaps it wasn't surprising in the end that this was something that was rediscovered not after 50 years, but after 80 million years. So we can be really wrong about this sometimes. The world's still a mysterious place, especially if you go down into the ocean. So we've got these problems of ambiguities and probabilities. I'm afraid most things in ecology are not ever definite. They're sort of, well, maybe. there's levels of uncertainty. And actually, if you think about the way people talk about climate change, which I'll talk more about tomorrow, that's always framed in terms of probabilities as well, because we have good models that can make predictions, but we can never be certain. So I couldn't even talk about extinction without talking about the dodo. It's a classic icon of extinction. I don't know, maybe in a million years the guinea pig will be too, but for now we've still got guinea pigs. So what do we do with the dodo? How do we know that's extinct? I mean, maybe there are dodos running around in Mauritius that we haven't seen. Well, you can do a mathematical analysis of the last few sightings of dodos and be pretty damn certain that there aren't any left. So what this shows is a couple of hundred years, and the bolded years are those where a dodo had been sighted. So there's one in 1598 and a couple in the early 17th century. And then it was sort of some scatterings occasionally popped up again. And the last one was seen in 1662. Now, dodos were persecuted by pigs which arrived on the island, and sailors used to drop off and restock their supplies of meat using dodo. I don't know whether it was very good to eat, but it was a relationship with a pigeon. So it may well have been. But anyway, the last one was seen in 1662, and that's the official extinction date, because it was the last one we saw. But almost inevitably, we didn't see the last dodo. We saw one of the last ones when it was very rare. So how can we conclude whether it is really extinct, and if so, when it went extinct? Well, you can do a statistical analysis of these data, and I'll spare you the gory detail. But what it essentially says is the most probable date for extinction was 1690. So that's, you know, over 30 years after, almost 30 years after the last one was actually seen. But there's a lot of uncertainty there. So it could have actually gone extinct anywhere between about 1669 and 1797, because we had quite large spacings between the last few records. So it obviously was getting very rare and hard to see. But we can be certain that it's not around anymore. Well, we can't be certain, but we can be 99.99% probable. So there's no more dodos. Now, this method can be used more generally to look at species like that monkey and the river dolphin and say, well, based on past observations, how likely is it to go already be extinct? And we can put a probability on it. Some things that are declining can be a very high probability. Other things that are naturally rare, then we would be fairly uncertain. And it would be worthwhile going out and continuing to do surveys, see if we can find these organisms. Okay, let's step back now, away from the concept of extinction specifically, and think about how extinction has influenced the progression of life through time. So I'll give you a really brief rundown of the history of life. And I apologise to all those species which I skim over, because there's a lot of them. All right, so life probably started 3.5, maybe 3.8 even, giga-years ago. That means billion years ago. So the Earth was formed around 4.6 billion years ago, at the same time as the Sun. But in the early part of Earth's history, it was totally inhospitable. It was essentially a molten ball of rock being bombarded constantly by asteroids, because there were a lot of debris flying around in the solar system. Things had settled down by about 3.6 giga years ago. And there's evidence for some of the first cyanobacteria. These are called prokaryote bacteria. Most simple sort of organisms. They haven't got any nucleus in their cell. They've just got chromosomes sitting in the cytoplasm. Fairly simple sort of thing. We call them blue-green algae. Well, there's evidence for these, including big colonies of them. If you go to Western Australia, there are cyanobacterial mats which are over 3 billion years old that we found. Earth stayed that way for a long while. So we're looking at another over a billion years, perhaps 2 billion years, until we see something which we can identify as more complex. And they're known as eukaryotes. We are eukaryotes. Almost all the animals you know about are eukaryotes. They're organisms which have a defined nucleus and defined organelles in their cells, things like mitochondria or chloroplasts and so on. The pathway towards more complex life. Now, these bacteria, which were originally eukaryotic organisms, microorganisms, these played a really important role in shaping the early history of life, because they changed the atmosphere. They did that over billions of years. I mean, we're doing it over a couple of centuries now. They did that over billions of years. But what they essentially did was enrich the atmosphere with oxygen such that more advanced life could start to develop. But occasionally things went very wrong in the history of the Earth. And 750 million years ago, that's MA, standing for mega years, and perhaps earlier as well, there were a couple of periods when the Earth's climate really did crazy things. And at one stage, it's been termed Snowball Earth, because it was good evidence to suggest that the Earth actually froze almost all the way, or perhaps even all the way to the equator. So it was just like one big snowball. But eventually what happened then was it shut down all these bacteria, and there was a gradual build-up of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that started to melt the ice, and then there was a runaway effect, and it became a hothouse. And then it's been estimated that the seas were, at one stage, perhaps 70 or 80 degrees Celsius. So only a few bacteria could exist then. So the Earth has done some really crazy things when it wasn't being strongly regulated by organisms. Then, around 580 million years ago, we have the first signs of complex life, multicellular life. So this is no longer single-celled organisms, building bodies. And the earliest ones come from, well, originally were found in the Ediacara hills of South Australia, and so they're called the Ediacara biota. They've also been termed the Vendo biota by some paleontologists who think they're a completely independent branch of life that died out and never went on to produce other multicellular organisms. We sort of started again from a new stock of unicellular organisms. That's still debated, but there were some fascinating, really weird sort of creatures that existed around that time. Then they just sort of dropped away again, and we didn't know much about them. They're now being found in other places around the world, but they're still a fairly elusive set of fossils. Then suddenly we had what's called the Cambrian explosion. And that's when we get oodles of fossils just suddenly appearing in the fossil record. And the big break seems to be that animals started to develop hard shells. And hard shells are really easy to fossilise. Soft bodies like worms and other mollusks and so on, they're really hard to fossilise, so you find them very rarely. So once you had shells, you had fossils. And from then on, we can document a great explosion of biodiversity, the Cambrian explosion, which led to almost all of the major phyla. These are these broadest groups, such as the chordates and the invertebrates, these major lines of in the history of life, all arose in the Cambrian explosion about 500 million years ago. The period from then on to the present has been known as the Phanerozoic. That means the era of visible life. That's when we can actually see life in the fossil record. So then we had a sort of classic progression, if you will call it that, where about 425 million years ago, the land was colonised by the most primitive plants and arthropods, and later by vertebrates. Then 250 million years ago, and I'll come back to this, life almost got wiped out completely. It's been estimated up to 96% of all species were, over a short period of time, eliminated. So essentially, the slate was wiped clean. This is the largest mass extinction event, as we call it, of all time. It ended a great era of life called the Paleozoic. Got a question? You can, in many cases, you can date the rock in which the organisms are preserved, and you can use dating which looks at the decay of radioisotopes. So some isotopes break down very slowly from one form to another. You can measure how much is broken down from that at the age of the rocks. So I'll come back to that Permian extinction, but it was a pretty important staging post in the history of life. But when we're talking about 96% of species going extinct in the Permian, was that a lot of species, or was that, you know, was life just getting started and there really wasn't much to go extinct anyway? Well, so to answer that question, we need to understand how diverse life was in the past. This is a diagram which shows a number of things. Along the bottom, it shows the major geological time period. So you see on one edge, there's the Cambrian. So this is the Phanerozoic era, visible life. Going right to the other side, the Cenozoic, is right at the end of that, is where we are now. And what it is essentially a compilation of all the fossil genera. So these are a level above species that have been recovered from the fossil record. And what it appears is that there was a long period of essentially stagnation when global biodiversity levelled off, and then it suddenly erupted, and it's been increasing up until the present. But the graph below shows that there's been a number of major spikes. There's a lot of spikes there. The five largest ones are called the Big Five, the five mass extinction events, and the biggest spike is that one I just talked about at the end of the Permian. So most of those genera that were represented, and there were thousands of fossil genera there, were wiped out. Problem is, the fossil record, even with shelly things, is really incredibly patchy. And it's been estimated that perhaps we've recovered 0.1% of all the fossils that have ever species that have ever existed. So 99.9% of all species are totally unknown to science. We can only infer their presence. So how do we infer it? Well, there are a number of lines of evidence we can potentially use to do that. One of them is by looking at the great variety of organisms that exist now, which we term biodiversity, seeing how many millions of species we have, and then looking back over the last few million years and seeing how many of those have been fossilised. So if they were actually extinct now, would we have a record of them? And the answer is no. For almost none of them would we have a record. So that great diversity of perhaps 10 to 100 million species that exist now are almost entirely invisible in a fossil record, except for a few, such as the large vertebrates, which have big bones and are easily preserved, and some of the shelly organisms that live in the shallow oceans are easily preserved. That's about it. So we're missing almost everything. We've got a very narrow window into the past. We've got some understanding for well-studied groups what their extinction rate was in the past. So if we look at modern diversity and we look at the rate at which species get lost in the past, we can use those two numbers to calculate how many species may have existed throughout the history of life. But these are all very rough sort of estimates. The other way we can infer past biodiversity is through a German term called Lagerstätten, and that means in German bonanza, roughly translated. I hope there's no Germans in the audience. Lagerstätten are these windows in the past where we see most things, because under extraordinary conditions, everything's preserved, even the soft-bodied organisms. So occasionally we get these snapshots into the past where we see that life was incredibly diverse, whereas if we looked at the same age rocks in other areas of the planet, we find almost nothing. So we know that we're missing most things. It's been estimated, using these different methods, that there may have been trillions of species that have existed, evolved, and gone extinct, and are totally unknown to us. All we see is the largest, boniest or shelliest things. Almost everything else is missing. So one example of Lagerstätten, which is particularly famous, comes from Canada, and it's called the Burgess Shale Fauna. Shale is a type of rock, it's called mudstone. And what happened here was you had this diverse ecosystem that existed in a shallow sea around 30 million years ago, so just sort of a bit after the start of the Cambrian explosion. And it was buried by a subterranean landslide. And almost everything was trapped in its deoxygenated sands and mud, killed instantly and preserved, buried in this blanket. And now we look at these shales and we find these incredible worms, and a picture there shows this great predator of a trilobite, which originally they just found the jaws and they thought it was a headless shrimp. But then they later found the rest of the body and realised it was a thing called an anomalocaris, which was a trilobite predator. Trilobites are one of the few things that we know a lot about because they've got these hard shells and are easily preserved. There were these weird worms called Ophibinia there, and there was these really crazy things called Hallucigenia, which are like nothing that's ever existed since, and people don't know what phyla they even exist in. So there's a lot of really crazy stuff that we didn't know anything about. And you look in rocks from that Cambrian of the same age elsewhere, you see trilobites, and you don't see those crazy worms and Hallucigenia and all that. So it's only in these windows that we get an idea of just how much has gone extinct, how much past biodiversity there was. So extinctions in the Earth's deep past is obviously pretty important, because almost everything that's ever existed has actually gone extinct. And of course it's the final event in the history of the life of any particular species. So it's worth understanding a bit about how they've shaped biodiversity in the past. How do extinctions occur? Well, we can guess that there are a number of processes that might unfold to cause extinction. One of them is simply being outcompeted. That may be that a new organism, a new species, invades an area and is competitively superior, better at finding food, better at acquiring territory, for instance, maybe is a predator on many other species, so directly or indirectly causes extinctions. Then you've got long-term environmental change, and if organisms are very specialised and not able to adapt to that change, that can be another process that drives extinction. So you get this gradual turnover in species which do well under some conditions but fail to do well under others. So new species evolve who can cope better with the new conditions. But actually, probably most important, they were sort of old 19th century, early 20th century ideas. A lot of paleontologists now think, in fact, that almost all extinctions are caused by random shocks. So we have everything going along very nicely, and then bang, almost everything's wiped out. That may be in a local scale, a regional scale, very occasionally on a global scale. Now, I'll talk a bit more later about what those shocks may be. So it could be that almost all extinctions are caused by very rare events for which nothing has evolved to cope with because they happen so infrequently. If we look back at climate over the Earth's history, this is charting what we can infer about changes in temperature over the last 540 million years, that Phanerozoic eon, then that's been quite variable, but it's been over very long periods in the main. So we've had very warm periods, we've had very cold periods where we've had glaciations. The modern glaciations, and that includes an ice cap on Antarctica and the Arctic, is a fairly recent thing. That's only happened in the last 10 to 20 million years. But before that, around the time of the dinosaurs, for instance, Earth's climate was about 5 to 6 degrees warmer, incidentally what we might get to at the end of this century, and there were no ice caps whatsoever. So Earth was a much hotter tropical place, and there were trees growing at the South Pole. But over the last few million years, we've actually been descending into a new ice age and incrementally getting colder and colder. So this is a major long-term environmental change. And with those changes in temperature come major changes in the configuration of the continents as they move around the Earth and in the sea level. This is based on a couple of reconstructions, and sorry, the graph's sort of flipped around from the other one. So now we've got the most recent times here. But what you can see, quite remarkably, is that sea level has been up to 400 metres higher than it is now. It's actually been well over 100 metres lower than it is now. So we've had major, major fluctuations in sea level over time. That's obviously going to have an impact on nearshore communities and on those that live around the coastlines especially, but it also has a big impact on the climate itself. So these are long-term processes, but there are occasional short-term climatic reversals that can also cause major shifts. The very short-term ones are some of those shocks that I talked about which may induce extinctions because they happen so rapidly, things can't evolve in time to cope with them. Probably the most famous example of a shock causing extinction is at the end of the Cretaceous period, 65 million years ago, when the dinosaurs and a number of other groups went extinct. The major culprit has now been identified pretty positively through many different lines of evidence as a large bolide striking the Earth. Now, this is actually a famous picture, but it wasn't that big, because if it was that big, it would have split the Earth in two. In fact, it was about 10 kilometres wide, which, in terms of the context of the entire globe, is minuscule, but because it's travelling so fast, it releases an incredible amount of energy. But what it did do is throw a lot of ejecta up into space and spread rock and dust throughout the atmosphere. It caused effectively a nuclear winter, followed by a period of global warming. It was a major shock, totally unexpected, very rare, that caused a major loss of biodiversity. Now, imagine if you didn't have a 10-kilometre-sized asteroid, you had a 1-kilometre-sized asteroid or a 100-metre asteroid. You can see that depending on the size of the asteroid or comet strike, that would change the amount of damage that it did and potentially the number of species that go extinct. So if you look back at these curves again, this graph we looked at earlier, there's lots of these extinction spikes. And a few paleontologists, people who study past life, have suggested that maybe all of these spikes are driven by things like bolides, or maybe the eruption of large volcanoes, these unexpected shocks to the Earth's environment that suddenly induce extinctions. And you can draw up a curve like this. This is called a kill curve. And this is not actually just some mythical thing out of the mind of a theoretical biologist. You can fit data to this in paleontology and show that the extinctions, that previous curve, wait a minute. If you line all those up cumulatively, then you come up with something like that. So what that is suggesting is that the bigger the shock, the longer you wait. And the very largest asteroids or very largest volcanic events and so on, they occur very rarely. Now, perhaps something that wiped out the dinosaurs occurred once every 100 million years, which seems like a long while, but when you think that visible life has been around for 500 million years, you might expect five of them. And there's a big five extinction events. So it may be that each of those extinction events is linked to an asteroid strike like this. And there's good evidence that, in fact, A lot of them are. And when you go right down to regional extinctions or local extinctions, which don't cause devastation on a global scale, but may wipe out whole communities within a particular continent or within a particular biogeographic realm, the net problem is caused by smaller shock events, but still rapid changes.
You are listening to Dr. Barry Brook at the International Science School in Sydney, Australia. His topic is extinction, past and present.
So let's reflect back on what I just talked about and think about some of the characteristics of mass extinctions. They're defined as mass extinctions because they cause a major loss of biodiversity. Generally, it's accepted as between 40 to 90% of biodiversity. Theoretically, if we got hit by a large enough asteroid, could be 100%. We've never encountered that so far. The question was, is there any theoretical reason for the shape of that curve? It actually does look like a theoretical curve. It looks like a logarithmic relationship. And, you know, you get asked this question a lot throughout ecology. Almost everything seems to obey logarithmic type relationships in ecology. And it's not entirely clear why, except that this is an event which involves risk. And so it's an intersection of probability and magnitude. And when you intersect those two events, you tend to get a logarithmic type relationship like this. So the larger the magnitude event, the lower the probability, that tends to generate a relationship like this. But there's a lot of arguing as to why it should have this shape. No one is entirely sure, no. So it is actually an empirical result, that one, which means a result based derived from data rather than derived from theory. Could be tomorrow, could be in 50 million years' time. That's something that's averaged over 3.5 billion years. And so sometimes they might be clustered pretty closely together, other times they might be really widely spaced. And that's something which we might be able to infer by counting all of the rogue asteroids out there, which we're starting to do, but it's not an easy question to answer. But you could be pretty sure that we have more immediate problems than worrying about that. If we just worried about consequence, of course, every scientist in the world would be an astronomer looking for these, because this is the biggest consequence that could possibly happen to life. But because it's such an improbable event of actually occurring in any particular year, doesn't tend to get that much attention. But in a long-term context, deep time, seems to be a pretty important driver of biodiversity. So, mass extinctions, a major loss of biodiversity, that's why they're called mass extinctions. But another feature is that their taxonomic impact is not random. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I mean that certain groups were vulnerable for one reason or another, and other groups were not. So it may have been that a whole collection of herbivore species, of large browsing herbivores, suddenly went extinct, whereas maybe grazing herbivores didn't. Those sort of distinctions between which groups, which functional ecological groups go extinct and which ones don't, can give clues as to the sort of after effects and the drivers of these extinctions. Generally, those that went extinct were not those that were pre-adapted to doing well beforehand. So you can get a major turnover of species and species groups, which are quite different after the event compared to before the event. So the survivors of those events tend to be those which are fortuitously pre-adapted to cope with these threats. So what I mean by that is they just happen to have the biological, ecological features that enable them to cope with this sort of shock. So if you look back at the Cretaceous event, for instance, all the dinosaurs went extinct. Dinosaurs are strictly terrestrial organisms. They only live on the land. The plesiosaurs and the ichthyosaurs, which are not dinosaurs, they'd actually gone extinct 20 million years beforehand for other reasons. But other large aquatic things, such as crocodiles and things which lived in the ground, which were most of the mammals at that time, they survived. Now, it may have been that their habits, their behaviour, their ecology made them fortuitously pre-adapted to surviving these events because they could essentially hide from the catastrophe that was going on at the surface, on the land, and get through it. What does tend to happen is you get these synergistic and cascading impacts. What I mean is that one thing causes another thing, and often they're a self-reinforcing effect. So you might get the asteroid strike, which kills everything in the immediate vicinity, but also throws up all these hot embers into the atmosphere, which causes a global wildfire, which burns down all the trees on a planetary scale, which then causes ferns to be able to grow, which favour a particular organism, but also then you get all this dust in the atmosphere, which shuts off sunlight. All these effects which sort of carry on from each other, And that can mean that they're much more devastating than just the initial effect itself. So as a localised affair, a 10-kilometre asteroid will produce a 300-kilometre-wide crater. Pretty devastating if you're in that 300 kilometres, but if you're outside it, that's not what kills you. It's all the other cascading effects. But a key signal of these mass extinctions, which is the point I'm trying to get across, is that they unfold rapidly. They're really fast events. They're not these slow, drawn-out events that you tend to think about when you're taught about evolution. They're very rapid events in which evolution is overwhelmed and things just change suddenly. And that's why they can cause such substantial extinctions. Okay, let's move forward in time now, many millions of years, much closer to the present day. So if we think back to this climate change curve, we're now focusing on this area, time when the Earth was very cold. If we zoom in on that area, and this is what Earth's temperature has reconstructed from the ice cores and other evidence looked like over those past few million years. There's a lot of fluctuations and a gradual descent into very cold conditions. Now, there's some strong technical reasons as to why you've got these fluctuations. They're basically caused by changes in the Earth's orbit and the Earth's inclination that bring these large cycles into play. These are known as the Milankovitch cycles, for those who are interested in the technicalities, and they've driven the recent ice ages. Now, this didn't happen beforehand because the continents were in different areas. But once you got most of the continental mass in the northern hemisphere, then small imbalances in the Earth's orbit was enough to cause major swings in the Earth's climate. So as you got more and more land mass up in the northern hemisphere, you tended to get these larger and larger swings in climate. But we had a lot of organisms which were able to survive all the way through there, and that mammoth was one of them. So mammoths, you know, have been around for a few million years. They were able to survive these large swings in temperature, and we're talking at a global scale of perhaps 5 or 6 degrees changes, going from a couple of kilometres of ice over somewhere like New York to being warmer than the present day. And with those changes in temperature came changes in sea level, for instance. You hear talk in the modern context of climate change about small amounts of sea level that may occur this century. Well, at the end of the last ice age, around 18,000 years ago, the sea level started to rise quite rapidly. And at its steepest rise, it was perhaps a metre every 20 years. So it was really shooting up. And sea level went from 120 metres below the current level to the current level over just a few thousand years. So at the last ice age, continental Australia was connected to Tasmania and New Guinea. It was all just one big continent. Japan was connected to mainland Asia. England was part of mainland Europe. And there was a lot more land, and there was a lot more exchange of organisms. And that was shut off when the sea levels rose. So if you imagine that we can't have major sea level rise in the future, then you only have to look back a few thousand years to see that that's actually a common event in the history of the Earth. But what caused those extinctions? Was that climate change in that case, or was it something else? Well, let's think about those shocks in a different way. A new shock has arrived on the Earth recently, and that's us. So there's this new species, which are very adaptable, very generalist, are predators. So our main business is going out and hunting and killing things, at least it was until quite recently. Well, some could argue it still is. So we suddenly had this new shock to these systems. And as people moved out from Africa and spread out into Europe and Asia and Australia and the Americas, they were like an asteroid that suddenly hit these new areas with this biota, which was naive to these adaptable semi-naked apes with spears, these new predators. And it's been theorised that they caused the loss of major biodiversity thousands, maybe tens of thousands of years ago. So in Australia, we had a lot of magnificent creatures which no longer exist. This is two examples. This is not someone who went back in a time machine and took photographs. This is actually some models from outside of Adelaide, but it gives you an idea of what they may have looked like. There was this critter here, which they think was a bit like a marsupial analogue of a hippo. There were some very large kangaroos, such as a flat-faced kangaroo here. In fact, there was a whole menagerie of things. There was even a carnivorous possum called Phylacoleo. It was about the size of a lion. It was a very ferocious organism. And there was a marsupial sloth, and this was the largest marsupial that's ever existed. It was called Diprotodon. It was a relationship of the wombat. There were large-sized Tasmanian tigers, which weren't from Tasmania then. They were throughout all of Australia. there were mega echidna and so on. But then humans arrived, and this is a story that's unfolded on all the different continents, and suddenly all these megafauna, as we call them, these large-bodied animals, went extinct. And all we know about them now, or almost all, is their remains that have been preserved in caves and other fossil deposits. So this is from outside of Narracourt in South Australia. There was some cave there which are preserved things like that giant wombat, Diprotodon. This is from a newly discovered cave in the Nullarbor, and that's called Thylacoleo. And there's some other large kangaroos. So that's how we know about them. Although, tantalisingly, there is some rock art from Northern Australia which has pictures of things which look a bit like megafauna. So it may be that the very first Aborigines actually drew them.
If these animals were so big and ferocious, how could early humans be able to cause their extinction?
That's a good question. I'm about to answer that. So we'll move ahead and I'll tell you. So what we've got is this coincidence, apparent coincidence, between humans arriving and the megafauna going extinct. So if you think about this as essentially all the fossils of megafauna, they decline up to about this period, and the archaeology, which is stone tools and other evidence of people arriving, sort of increases around that period. So we've got this confidence limit of overlap here, where they both seem to have been together. And that decline is just a cumulative thing, so it doesn't mean that the actual megafauna had declined over time. So what it suggests is that there was a few thousand years here when humans and megafauna in Australia overlapped. So yeah, a lot of people have argued, well, so what? You know, these marsupial lions and these giant wombats and so on, how could people have hunted those to extinction? Well, first you've got to look at the coincidence of these events throughout the world. So we had people evolved in Africa, you know, around 200,000 years ago, we get an extinction event. People arrive in Australia, we get an extinction event. They arrive in North America, we get an extinction event. Madagascar, New Zealand, the West Indies, the Pacific Islands. Everywhere where we see a recent extinction event, we see people arriving. Now, with the larger things, it's been shown through modelling that you don't actually need to hunt larger things. You can actually just hunt the juveniles, you know, so the young at foot. You can use trapping methods. You can use fairly simple hunting technologies that only take a few of the largest animals, and that can be enough to tip them over the edge, because large animals do very well without predators that can hunt them, at least, by taking a long while to reproduce, having very precocious young that are able to that are very large and able to sustain themselves through periods of fluctuations in weather and so on. But what they're not very good at doing is replacing themselves quickly. So you've got organisms which are very resilient to changes in short-term climate, but are not resilient at all to sudden increases in mortality caused by hunters or other predators. And humans didn't just hunt as well. They did major engineering of the environment through fire. In Australia, there's pretty good records of increases in burning when humans arrived, changing a landscape from one in which fire was always there, but it was a fairly rare thing that may have burnt large patches of habitat and then left other areas long unburnt. When humans arrived, they developed this fine-scale mosaic. So they'd burn very regularly, keep areas open for game that they like to hunt, such as kangaroos. They really did change the landscape in a major way through fire. Of course, since Europeans have arrived in places like Northern Australia, their methods have been to keep fire suppressed, either by having areas completely unburnt for decades, mostly the case in southeastern Australia, which is why we get those wildfires occasionally. In Northern Australia, it's basically to burn almost every year. So in the Northern Territory, where I was previously, it's been estimated that every square metre of the Northern Territory gets burnt on average every 3 years. So that's very regular fires. And that's a major change that the biota has to evolve to cope with. And we're able to show this by doing some sort of funky modelling of landscapes. This is an example of a model I did where we've got the red here, which is a model of fire, and this is a model of a type of grass, and we can look at how that grass evolves under different fire regimes over time, just sort of by running the simulation forward. Now, you do that over many simulations, over large scales, and you tend to get these big patterns emerging, and from that you can link that to the ecology of organisms and try and understand the processes that might lead to favouring some species and being detrimental to others, and therefore potentially leading down the path of extinction. So for the megafauna, we can use models that we've built of large megafauna that still exists today in places like Africa, where people evolved, potentially co-evolved with them, such that they were able to survive early hunters. And we can look at different scenarios and base that on the data we have available, the sort of fossils that have been preserved, and essentially fit these model predictions to different sorts of data and exclude some ideas and support others. So this is a model that suggests, well, what if people were just hunting to provide their own subsistence needs? So the only reason they hunted megafauna was to have enough to eat. Well, that suggests that most of the small things should have gone extinct and most of the large ones should have been around. Whereas if you build in a different model of hunting where people actually go out to hunt because it's a prestige thing or it's an opportunistic thing where they just come across a large animal and they kill it because it happens to be around, or the men in the tribe are able to elevate their status and gain great prestige through his hunting, then you tend to get the reverse prediction. And this is what happened. This is what fits the data very well. So this suggests that it was simply because these megafauna were large, they were able to be opportunistically hunted by people, you didn't need much extra hunting to tip them over the edge, that you got extinctions. So this is an example of where the models can be compared to the data to make us a bit more confident in our predictions.
Is there a certain limit whereby you define what's a large mammal or megafauna, is there a size boundary?
Well, if you look at that graph, I guess you'd say no. It's sort of a continuous thing. It's often been said megafauna or anything larger than 44 kilograms, which happens to be 100 pounds in the American scale, and so that's what tends to be classified as megafauna. But in fact, you've got minifauna and mesofauna and megafauna and mega-megafauna and so on, and it's really just a continuum of sizes. So Australia's lost most of its megafauna, but actually just recently we've got a lot of it back in a different form. So in northern Australia, we have Asian water buffalo. These are fulfilling a role in the landscape which is potentially similar to some of the megafauna, such as that hippo-like marsupial that used to exist. This is an example of a new sort of environmental engineering post-extinction where we can restore some of the ecosystem function. I'll talk a bit more about that tomorrow. So we've talked about extinctions in the deep past, in the recent past. Now we'll talk about the really recent times, the last few hundred years. We've seen extinctions of island species. This is an island rail. It's been estimated that maybe 2,000 species of rail have gone extinct in the Pacific Islands since people arrived. This is mostly the Polynesian settlers. But then when people arrived in North America, they hunted things like the passenger pigeon and also, in this case, destroyed the forests on which they depended. The bison in the Great Plains, it was estimated there may have been 100 million bison in the Great Plains. Almost all of those were wiped out over a period of about 20 years of hunting. And this pile of skulls gives you an idea of the magnitude of that sort of hunting that went on. These are you know, large, very large animals. You can imagine how much biomass that represents. It's an incredible amount. And in Australia, famously, you have iconic symbols such as the Tasmanian tiger, which used to exist throughout all of Australia. It went extinct soon after the arrival of the dingo, about 4,000 years ago, and then was restricted to Tasmania, where the dingo didn't reach, because by that time the seas had risen and Tasmania was isolated. And then after Europeans arrived with dogs and guns, they hunted that to extinction as well. In Central Australia, we have a number of extinctions which are pretty difficult to explain, in that many of them occurred before people arrived. But recent work has suggested that all 22 of them can actually be strongly or very strongly attributable to the arrival of the red fox. So the fox was introduced into Australia, and there's basically this wave of small mammal extinctions that unfolds as the fox spreads throughout Australia. One place it didn't get was northern Australia, and that's where, if you look in the bright light area, that's where the extinctions of small mammals are fewest. So around the arid area, where foxes do very well, we had many, many mammal extinctions. Australia's actually got the worst record of mammal extinctions of any continent. And basically that figure, that map of extinctions of mammals in Australia charts very well the expansion and relative habitat preferences of the red fox. And there's many other lines of evidence to suggest the same. So in that case, that was actually people who did that, because it was people who brought a European animal to a new continent, but it was in an indirect way.
Is that the reason because the dingoes in Tasmania, or was it competition between
probably more likely to be competition in that case. That it was the Tasmanian tiger was a solitary hunter, whereas the dingo was a pack hunter, and so it tended to be efficient at driving thylacines away from its prey. And so there's evidence in Tasmania of dog packs which would hound off a tiger once it had made a kill. The Tasmanian tigers were extremely... they had a very high level of endurance, and they used to kill prey by just hunting them down, running them down for hours and hours. Once they caught something, the dogs would come in and drive them off. And that tends to be suggested as to why they caused that extinction. The Tasmanian devil, which was also on the mainland, hung around in Victoria till about 400 years ago. And that was a scavenger, so it may have been able to do a bit better with the dingo.
Back on the last slide, there's like a spike in the graph.
That's actually just a record, sorry, I was asking about the spike there. This is just one record from one of many properties. So you see we're only talking about 15 individuals there. So once you compile all those records together, you get an idea of this is the number killed per year. And it's a fairly gradual thing, consistent thing, and then suddenly the population crashes by the early 1900s. So today we've got things which still hang on and are not extinct, but are threatened, and they may be through changes in landscape or changes in fire regime and so on. It's a Gouldian finch, and it's a Carpentarian rock rat. These are what is known as critically endangered or threatened species that are still hanging on but are approaching extinction. So if we had to reflect back on what I've been talking about and consider what would be the candidate species for being most vulnerable to going extinct, we can make a bit of a list. We can say those species which are naturally geographically restricted are more vulnerable because they're more likely to suffer from a catastrophic shock. Remember that scaling of shock to time, you get a shock more likely to wipe out a system when it's in a restricted geographical area and it can't be repopulated from any other area. Similarly, if you have low dispersal, which means you can't get mixing of species from one area to another, what's been termed a rescue effect, if you're just isolated in a single population, that's again when you're more likely to go extinct. Of course, if you've got a small population size, that makes you more vulnerable too. I'll talk more about that in a minute. Low genetic diversity, that means you have less innate capacity to change your biology such that you suit a new environment. And if you've been co-evolved with something else that you depend on, another species, then that can also cause you to go extinct if that dependent species also goes extinct for maybe a completely different reason. So from these general principles, we can draw up what I've called extinction rules, these generalities that seem to hold across extinction throughout time. One of them is that large body things, represented in this curve as you go up to larger body size, tend to be more vulnerable to rapid shocks, such as people arriving or an asteroid and so on, than things which have a short generation time, which also tends to be correlated with body size. So small things tend to reproduce quickly, die quickly, and are able to cope with a new threat which causes higher mortality. Whereas if you have a threat which is a more long-term thing, so occurs over the generation scale of an organism, there really doesn't seem to be much difference in body size. So big things are more vulnerable to sudden events. Small things may actually even be more vulnerable to survive longer-term changes because that doesn't their short generation length doesn't give them any resilience to cope with that threat. So that's one idea of a generality which seems to hold pretty well. This is getting back to that idea of co-evolved species. There are many of them, in fact. It's been estimated that for every vertebrate that exists, there's a parasite or three that also exist just for that vertebrate. We've got our own special skin louse and hair louse and other microorganisms that live in our gut and so on that are found only in humans. And that seems to be common throughout the animal kingdom. So that if you've got a species going extinct, you'll have a couple of co-evolved parasites that go extinct with them. Well, in this case, these were some butterflies from Singapore, where locally, almost all the trees in Singapore have been cut down over the last 200 years or so, and a number of butterfly species that were dependent on those particularly their caterpillars, were dependent on particular trees, also went locally extinct. This is a study I did which showed that if you look at all of the threatened species on the World Conservation Union threatened list, the greater majority of them have lower genetic diversity than a related species which is not threatened. So when you're threatened, one of the characteristics is you tend to have lower genetic diversity. When you get to small size, by chance you tend to lose a lot of your genetic diversity. Now that becomes pretty important when you're trying to evolve to cope with a new threat, because evolution basically works on the raw material of genetic diversity. If you've got everything in a population which is exactly the same, then there's no selection pressure. So nothing does better than anything else. They all do the same. So either everyone does well, which is great, but in other cases, everyone does badly. But if you have more of a spread of competitive ability, where in some situations some particular organisms do well and other ones they don't, that's when you can have evolution occurring. So if you lose genetic diversity, you lose the capacity to change, to cope with a changed environment. At some point, there's a small enough population size where we say it's a minimum viable population size, and below that, it's a pretty arbitrary sort of figure, but below a couple of thousand individuals, this is a figure showing MVPs, as they're called, minimum viable population sizes, calculated for thousands of species. If you get below that, then you tend to be drawn into this vortex, which we've sort of colourfully called the extinction vortex. I'll illustrate briefly what happens. So if you think of extinction as being at the centre of that, then originally you might have an abundant species, which is found most everywhere. But for one reason or another, and in the modern context, that may be through habitat loss or pollution or overhunting or some introduced species, you get a decline. So something that was once locally or globally abundant becomes rare because of these systematic factors. So you become a small or fragmented or isolated population. Now at that point, you tend to have more frequent breeding with close relatives, which causes inbreeding depression, and also causes the loss of genetic diversity. So if you think back to that previous figure, that's when you start to get this erosion of the raw material of evolution. And that causes a reduction in adaptability, and also survival rates and reproductive rates tend to go down. Now at some point, when that causes the population to decline, you get a reduced population size. So it gets even smaller. And at that point, you have other things which can become important that weren't previously important. Something that was previously just damaging in one part of their range suddenly becomes damaging in the whole part of their range because they've been more restricted. So let's say we had a species found on 100 islands in the West Indies and a cyclone hits 20 of them and wipes out those populations. Fine, there's still an 80 of them. But what if they've been restricted to just those 20 islands through other processes? Then suddenly that cyclone becomes a killer blow. That's why as you become small and more restricted, you're more likely to go extinct. And of course, you're more likely to decline the smaller populations, in which case you're more likely to lose more genetic diversity, and survival and reproduction will go down, and you'll get even smaller, and you'll be even more vulnerable to those, and you'll get even, and so on. So you get sucked down into this extinction vortex. So it's been demonstrated pretty well through both models and experiments that below a certain size, species get drawn down quickly to extinction. So it's not as though most of them sort of peter along and very slowly meander their way down to nothing. Basically, they start off abundant, they get reduced to a small size, and pretty quickly they get drawn down to extinction through these self-reinforcing processes, the extinction vortex. So things which are on the edge are threatened. The big worry for conservation biologists is to avoid them getting drawn into this extinction vortex, to keep population size large enough that these processes aren't important, keep them as widely distributed as possible, to make them resilient against these sort of threats, which may be quite independent of the original causes of their decline. So it's a bit like if you're flying in an aircraft and suddenly the rivets started to pop out of the wing, then that would cause a wing to fall off and your plane would crash. Well, you wouldn't actually die because the rivets popped out, you'd die because you hit the ground. But it was the rivets that popped out actually caused you to go extinct. Well, it's a sort of similar analogy here. These are the rivets popping out. In other words, you're losing ecological function and you're reducing in size. Eventually you hit the ground. That's extinction. So some generalisations for extinction. Sort of getting back to a summary of those points. If you're large, then you're resilient to extinction. big populations are unlikely to go extinct. I mean, that's quite a sort of sensible thing. But when you look at the context of what I've been talking about today, you can see that it's actually a pretty fundamental point, that it's good to be big. Similarly, it's good to be widely dispersed, so that if you have local shocks and catastrophes, you can survive that and you can repopulate your geographical range because you're buffered against those short-term shocks. Something occurs very quickly, and that can be the difference between adapting and coping or going extinct. So the rate of impact, something that's a random shock, happens very quickly, much more likely to cause extinction than a gradual process which allows species to adapt. And then the whole idea of something which is extinction prone or not is very context specific. Everything evolves in one way or another to be really good at what it does. Now, if you're a specialist, let's say you're a honey eater that feeds on the nectar of a particular type of flower, well, as long as that flower is there and that forest that supports the flower is there, you do fine. But let's say that bit of forest gets cleared and the flowers aren't there anymore, then you've got nothing to feed on. Suddenly, you're very extinction prone. So if the threat involves removing that flower, you're extinction prone, whereas if the threat involves a new competitor coming in, you may actually still do much better than them because you're evolved to do very well with that feeding on that particular flower. So the things that drives extinction tend to be new stresses and rapid stresses. So that comes to my final point in today's talk, which is that there is a new threat, a new shock that causes rapid changes over a broad scale, and that's humans. Now, in the distant past, which I talked about earlier, Stone Age people moving throughout the continents of the world caused major extinctions. They caused a major shock to these systems, and the most vulnerable species to those initial shocks, hunting and fire and habitat clearance, were the large-bodied organisms. Now we're moving into a new century where we're having quite different and profound impacts on the environment in ways that we never previously did. So we have this thing called technology, which is allowing us to essentially be a new shock again. So we're able to exert these new pressures on the environment that we never previously did. There's more and more of us each year. For hundreds of thousands of years, the human population was very low. At most, there were a couple of million people. Then, over the last few thousand years, the human population maybe increased to 100 million. And then, over the course of the 20th century, it's exploded to 6 billion. And it's projected, these are various projections, which all carry a burden of uncertainty, but it's projected that the human population will be anywhere between 14 billion or maybe have maintained its current number at about 6 billion after peaking at about 9 billion by mid-century. However you read that, there's going to be a lot of us around for the rest of this century unless something really catastrophic occurs. And our technology is continually advancing. We're getting the developing world introducing new technologies that may have existed in Europe and North America and Australia are now being used in developing countries and having a major impact on those areas where there's still a lot of residual biodiversity. So we're seeing a new shock. We're seeing lots of new threatened species. If you're interested in finding out more about threatened species, incidentally, you look in a chapter of the book, there's a number of links there, including one to the IUCN Red List, which lists all of the species that are threatened right now and the processes that are causing those threats. It's quite an interesting website. So that's us doing that now. We are the new shock. So if you look back in the distant past, there's been occasional events. We've had those mass extinctions, spectacular losses of species. But for most of the time, we maybe only lost one species every year. Out of perhaps 100 million species, one species a year, it's almost undetectable. Then humans started to spread throughout the globe and in pre-industrial times, caused major extinction. So a step up maybe of a thousandfold in the background extinction rate. Now in the future, it could be that we'll step that up to 10,000-fold, or maybe even more. So this century, I would consider, is a century of consequences, in that the consequences of our development and of our spread throughout the world and our new technology is really going to start to bite biodiversity in a big way. And we could be heading to what's been termed the sixth extinction. We had the big five before. This is the big six. And it's caused by another random shock, and that shock is us. So if you think back to some of the major drivers of mass extinctions in the past or changes in biodiversity, this is an example of the different scales of changes in climate over time. Well, this big, magnificent one here, which is occurring at a rate maybe 100 times faster than it ever has in the past, and potentially at a magnitude as great as it's ever occurred in the past, that's us. And that's only one of the things we're doing. So that and many more lovely things that we're doing to our planet this century and beyond is what I'll talk about tomorrow. Now I'm happy for questions.
That was the first of two lectures by Dr. Barry Brook on extinction, past and present. The second speech, The Future of Biodiversity in a Changing World, is available from www.scienceschool.usyd.edu.au. I'll give you that again, scienceschool.usyd.edu.au, or from ecoshock.org. Just choose Species from the Audio On Demand menu at ecoshock.org.